I was saying actually in conversation to you, James, that there does seem to be another convergence happening, perhaps, that there's sufficient tools out there, there's sufficient ways in which people are able to get at resources. Some of the limitations of the past have gone. But whether the convergence is about something also simple enough that it's not just the people in this room that find it interesting and are prepared to face it, and it's trying to grasp a simple enough thing to do that actually really can make a difference to how we use those tools and resources. But it's probably a better starting place now than it was 5 years ago. But whether it's actually a five-year better starting place, I'm not so sure.
Mm. No, I know what you mean. Any others who... Are we simple enough yet for people who don't come to these conferences to get the benefit? Mm. Sheila?
I don't know if we're simple enough. I think in some ways the discussions that we've been having over the last 5 years are getting, I think we're articulating the problem better within ourselves. I think that could complicate it more for the people who are not involved in these conversations. But I think the tools are becoming simpler. They're still complicated. So I think it's kind of, we're not quite there, but I think we are moving forward probably more than we realise. But I think there still is quite a gap. But there are certain things that I can see. Things like the widgets, in particular in terms of technology, I think that's something that people can get their head around very quickly because more people are using that kind of technology. So I think if we can try and get some more quick wins, that's going to help people bring more people into the conversation at the level that they want to engage in it as well.
Thanks.
I'm loud enough, I think.
You can't print your voice on tape.
Oh, I see. How do you know? Well, telepathically. it's sort of from that sort of early, the opening keynote, and then seeing these systems, they're trying to be many things to many people, and sort of in the spirit of things that presently are part of the LDSE project, more of an opinion, in order to sort of get everybody on board, all of these diversity and in sort of culture and technical ability, is to find a way of linking these separate, specialized sort of contexts or communities of practice or tools that support them and they're comfortable with by some other framework, rather than trying to sort of press everybody into one sort of way of or one technology or one community or one... or one meta theory as the goal one that you this morning described. So that's pretty much the thought that I had throughout the presentations today.
James, I'm just reflecting on this, are we simpler enough and what's it going to take and so on, and whether in 5 years we've made enough progress. And when you've been in this field many decades, 5 years is very long actually, and when you're thinking about what it takes to change things, the analogy I was groping for yesterday about the kind of thing we're trying to make is making the equivalent of pencil and paper for the teacher. To express themselves, to find out what it is they think. That's what writing is so brilliant at, and what the pencil and paper tool gave you. But think how long it took to develop writing implements that were really that easy to use. And 5 years isn't very long, really, for developing a creative design tool, which is actually fantastically complicated, because education is... in some sense, it's an awful lot more complicated than writing. So it took hundreds of years to develop a decent writing tool. It's going to take us a little bit longer than 5 years, maybe, to develop the digital tool that is the equivalent for understanding the teaching learning process in a form that makes it a creative design process. You know, so I think we have to regard ourselves as still groping towards what it's going to be, exploring it, trying to make sure that each little step is a benign step towards the thing we're really trying to do, keeping hold of the vision, recognizing that things like LAMS and the various other tools are, you know, they're sort of early versions of slate or something. We haven't quite got paper yet. But we're getting there, and we're beginning to discover what it is we have to create. Every time I see LAMS, I think there's fantastic progress. And I've just been in Ernie's, and had to leave Ernie's presentation on what the new version looks like, and it's incredibly impressive. So I think it gives us a tremendously valuable foundation on which to play and explore and discover what it's going to take. And it may not be the mainstream, it may only be the cognoscenti for a while, but we'll discover something in that process. So I'm refusing to be pessimistic, basically. And I think, you know, another 10, 5, 10 years, we'll do something significant.
Thank you. I think maybe if I can follow on from that. In previous contexts, I've talked about the development of music notation, and said that it took a few hundred years to get to a kind of stabilized way of writing down music that then was, you know, common for the next 400-500 years through to today. So, you know, we only have 295 years to go. Maybe not that long, but, yeah. Yeah, so let us hope. The other one that I often reflect on, I don't know how many of you have ever seen this, but when Tim Berners-Lee first was basically putting forward the idea of the World Wide Web, and he developed the first internet browser. It had a lot more features than today's internet browser. And what we today think of as often sort of Web 2, user-generated content, the idea that I, an average person with no special technical skills, can get text and pictures up on the web. You know, that just, I mean, it now seems very basic and simple, but that's only really taken off in mass use in maybe the last 5 years, possibly less. Well, Tim Berners-Lee's first web browser back in 1991 had those features. If you actually go back and look, it was designed to let you edit web pages and, you know, put up this material. And I find that fascinating because, in a sense, what he was saying was all the way back at the start of that idea of, you know, an interconnected web, he could see that people would create their own and edit it. But on the other hand, the tool at that time wasn't easy enough to use for whatever reason. But also, I suspect the world was not ready enough yet either. I mean, you know, every year after that, there were new tools which did help people to do stuff on the web, and they got a bit more adoption and so on. But it was really about, what are we talking, 15 years, maybe a bit less, till the Web 2 thing really took off. And, you know, my mum and my daughter both can edit web pages now, you know, and do, because it's just that easy. So I do think we have this challenge sometimes that even when we can kind of see over the horizon of where we think a field might go, it still can take quite a significant amount of progress. And I do think there are often sort of simplicities in tools that are, you know, seem very small, but when they finally come, they take off like wildfire. I mean, I'm going to borrow a joke from Michael Chasen, the CEO of Blackboard, if you'll forgive me. But he was trying to explain to a young intern who'd come to Blackboard different technologies that were being used on the web, and he was to go off and investigate them. And he was saying, oh, and you should have a look at listservs. And this, you know, young person now was 17, what's a listserv? They'd never heard of a listserv before, no idea what a listserv was. And Chasen says he had a sort of moment of insight. And he said, oh, it's like Twitter, but without the 140 character limit. And I think that's fascinating that Twitter is such, in a sense, such a small thing. Like its innovation of what it is really, but done in a way that just suddenly then, you know, and all the things around it let it take off. So in one sense, I feel comfortable with the idea we may have quite some way to go till we find the right simplifications of our very complex concepts that will help people use it, you know, in a broad way. I just hope we keep taking little steps that point us, you know, what those simplifications might be. Or Other reflections? Zip? Yan?
No. Yes.
Just picking up on the musical thing, and apologies for my age here, but another way that that metaphor makes me think is that we used to have big bands, and then along came rock and roll, and rock and roll was to simplify it. It said, we don't need all this complexity. Let's just have a drum and a box, and we'll bang away, and we'll do a whole lot of shaking or whatever. And 15 years down the line, you had Tales from Topographic Oceans for, all that ludicrous, complicated prog rock, for those of you who don't remember. It just got wildly out of control. And along came punk again, and it said, all we need is a guitar and a box. And we go through these cycles of complexity and simplification. And it's not because the simple is right or that the complex is right. It's that there is a domain here which we can articulate in lots of different ways. And all those different places are satisfactory to somebody at some point at some time. Somebody at some point wanted lots of synthesizers and tremendously complicated multi-track recording, and somebody else wanted to be banging away in a cellar. Mm-hmm. And they were right for those purposes. So those similar kinds of changes, I just feel there's some kind of processes going on here. And I don't see a promised land, and I don't think we're going to get there. Mm-hmm. I think we're going to be in a continual dialogue between with ourselves and with the emerging technology that will always lead us to be wondering whether we're in the right place now and what the payoffs and what the cost of being here is, what the opportunity cost was we could be over here. So I'm sorry, I don't think the lambs will ever be perfect, and we'll always have to have these conversations. So that's my take on the making progress. I think it's always going to be limited.
Surely that's the whole point, that we're educators anyway, because we know that things do change and we want things to change, so they should be changing. We don't want to get to the point where we've solved everything. There's always going to be something else we want to do, so we need to keep having the conversations.
I'm really heartened by the main research I've been doing in the last couple of years has been with learners and talking to learners and supporting projects that talk to learners about their experiences of e-learning, as we've called it, or learning with technology. And we've sort of really unpicked an awful lot of the myths about the Google generation. And the main one is that a lot of the vast majority of learners, students, still look to their tutors to be guided in their use of technology. And although we're saying, yes, 15 years on, everyone's editing web pages, well, actually, there's an awful lot of higher education students out there who are introduced to things like Twitter and writing their own blogs by their lecturers, mm-hmm. a very large number. And the idea that tutors are in flight from these incredibly technically sophisticated students is really, when you start talking to students, it's really undone. So I think we have a huge responsibility still, not just to be experts in what we happen to know, not just to be experts in pedagogy, but actually also to be experts in the technology, because the students are not doing it for themselves. And the students that we were interviewing included students from Edinburgh and Oxford, so they were not disadvantaged students, and they were still in that group that were quite happy to use this information to be consumers of blogs, of Twitter streams, of RSS feeds, but were largely not, until they were prompted to, creating wikis, were not creating blogs, were not active in exploring the potential of tools. They were using the potential that they'd been shown. So I think that really, I think the fact that we may feel we're talking to a small number of people, we're a very important small number of people mm-hmm. who are pioneering in education and in technology, and it really does matter. I'd just like to go back to Di's point, and wonder about the cute analogy with music and what we can draw from that, because music is a fantastically successful human enterprise. And I mean, the analogy you draw with that particular track through the history of music is perfectly fine. But when you think about what music is and how successful it is and the huge variety of accomplishment that we have in music and the tools and the forms of representation and everything that surrounds music, it's fantastically successful. Education isn't anywhere near as successful as music as a human enterprise. We have masses of universities and schools and all the rest of it, masses of books and so on. But the quality of human learning and achievement that comes out of all of that doesn't anywhere near match the quality, I don't think, of human entertainment and enjoyment and satisfaction that comes out of what we do with music. So the analogy that I draw from that is that we've still got a long way to go with education, what it can become, what it can yet become, and it can be a lot more successful. I don't know. I mean, it's harder to do, maybe, than music. I don't know why it's taken so long, but it's become institutionalized in a way that's not helpful. Over the last 100 years, we've been telling ourselves that the way we've always been doing it perhaps isn't so great, and that there's another way to think about teaching and learning. It's not just a matter of presenting your subject and transmitting knowledge to the next generation. It's a bit more complicated than that. Maybe it's going to take another 100 years to figure out then how to do it better and how to make sure we do it better. But I don't think it's always going to be as chaotic and unsuccessful as it is now. I think we can, over this coming century, with the tools that we've got available, start finding the way towards making it more successful, making it more like music. I mean, that's would be a great analogy to work to.
I'll fully accept the cuteness of the analogy may be misleading, but I'd only say I think that we couldn't have music without learning, and we couldn't have it without education. You know, the history of music is a result of people learning. So part of it, and we wouldn't have, and no, exactly. So a lot of the questions between our two descriptions is where we draw the boundary around this thing that we're calling education and learning, and the different ways that we describe how that process is going. I think that's where the two different views are, and I completely agree about the institutional issues being critical to this.
Any other thoughts? There are a number of people who've come here to this sort of conference for the first time. I'm particularly interested in any thoughts or reflections they have as they join here, or any other thoughts people have to add.
I kind of missed the first part of this speech. Can you hear me? But I am a musician. I studied at the Royal College of Music. And I don't think education and music are... there are very many different things, but I think we've got to look at humanware, not software, not hardware, but humanware. We've got to look at who we are as human beings and how we learn. And that's where the problem is, who we are. So that's a new term, maybe, for ICT, humanware, in this sense.
It troubles me from yesterday. There was some dialogue. Somebody said, you know, how do you sort of go about a teacher who wants to teach creatively art course, and, you know, you can't sort of frame them or anything. It's been with me for a while now that teaching is not a bohemian inspirational thing. It's got targets. It's like marketing almost. You know the audience demographics. You commission the creative people to get the message across. There is a set of triggers and criteria in which you design your intent into to materialize it. So it has an elements of creative, but the creative elements can be actually teased out by the set of recommendations from that you learned from the past. So you accumulate a set of It's almost writing music for a brief, for a film, or for a jingle, for a radio. It has to hit particular notes. It's not about creativity. It's not about something that is out there in the wild that you can't capture or define. It is a set of you can call it creativity, but I would disagree. It is sort of systematic sort of targeting of the sort of interventions that will yield the result that you are after. Whereas if you talk about painting or creative music composing, inspiration and things come into mind, and then you might then argue about creativity because there's no defined target. It's just the appeal of how catchy the tune is, but with the education, there is a definite target. In fact, one of the debates about what is the target of education, the simple answer is to create better human beings in the end. But it's a sort of, you know, you can unpack it into smaller goals and the subject domain specific goals. But these are nonetheless the goals that you have criteria of achieving, success criteria. It's not like just the free range, I feel like teaching today, that sort of thing. And that's where analogy with music, I don't quite find accurate. I mean, you might disagree. If you formally trained as a musician, there might be some sort of ways to achieve musical creativity. But I
do disagree that teaching is not creative. I don't know how far off topic this is, but my subject is creative writing, so I've taught creative writing, and I've had great flashes of insight into how to teach particular concepts to students. But I think I have then been able afterwards to describe why that was educationally a good idea, why it worked. So I didn't sit down mechanistically with a learning outcome and design something in that way, but I did afterwards reflect on why it worked. I mean, I in the bath one night came up with an idea for teaching students to write sonnets, which students find incredibly difficult, to make it really good fun and to make sure everyone walked out of a 15-minute class with a sonnet, and it works every time. And I could now describe why it works and why it works pedagogically and why it targets what is essential about a sonnet. But the insight was a creative one. So I think we can't make it a mechanistic process, but we can describe and share our pedagogic intentions without destroying the creativity that brings them into being.
But why do you call it a mechanistic process? Because you did have a learning outcome. You just described it.
Well, I had a very broad one. But that
it's all right. That doesn't make it mechanistic.
The treatise on creativity say that creativity, this is very, first of all, very much on the topic, because what we're trying to do is make innovation happen, and the way to make it happen is what we should be concerned with. And expertise is the precondition for creativity. Therefore, being familiar with all the tricks in the book, tacitly, implicitly, or explicitly, is the way to achieve that creativity, to even not think about it, but perform something that actually works. So I guess, you know, in the music analogy would be, if you write a jingle for a specific audience, for a specific product, you might not think of it as, oh, I'm going to, but use symbols that you're already very familiar with, musical symbols and instruments that would convey that idea. Similarly, when you create a piece of teaching, you know, if you're an experienced teacher, you might not think of it as I'm going to do this, I'm going to step to step 3, 4. But it's exactly the result of your experience that you are able to do that without even thinking about it. I mean, this is the psychology of creativity that I happen to sort of subscribe to, that I am able to understand. So I guess, I don't know if it's answered the question, but that's the sort of thoughts I had on that.
Given I think that I started the music analogy this morning, I feel obliged to say something. But One interesting bit for me about this is that there are certain music traditions, types of music, which are almost entirely improvisational. Okay, jazz can be one of the great examples, where there is no written music that you are playing from, and there may be only the most bare bones of structure that you work to, and you just make it up as you go. And that can be a great pleasure, and you have, you know, wonderful experiences doing that. Also, certain types of indigenous music, there is no notational system at all, you know, for their music. It's entirely a lived experience. So that's one, you know, dimension of music. And yet, on the other hand, we have, you know, the written music passed down to us, at least in the Western tradition and also in others, where we have the most extraordinary pieces of music from, you know, Bach and Beethoven and Mozart and others. And we today are greatly enriched by the fact that we can experience that musical experience they thought up 200, 300, and 400 years ago, because it was notated in the way that we still have it today and it's not lost. So there's this, for me, fascinating thing about, on the one hand, capturing great music in a way that is shared and passed down to others, but at the same time, there's other types of music, other musical experiences, which are completely different and completely improvisational. I try to apply that to education, and what strikes me about that is that we do both of these things in our teaching. As teachers, we improvise, we have great insights in the moment that we then go with and can have great teaching experiences. We also prepare lesson plans, or at least structures, or something that we particularly plan to, you know, achieve, and we might give them to colleagues and so on. So we have both of those elements in education. What I find interesting is that when you ask many people about great teaching experiences, great teachers they had, you know, to describe these things, it seems to me they very often describe the improvisational end of education. I've rarely heard someone say, can you tell me about a great teaching experience, you know, that you were part of? There was this lesson plan, and I tell you what, it had such a good structure to it, the way... That's not what you hear. And so there's something fascinating about the thing you often remember of great teaching, to me, sounds more up the improvisational end. And yet we still are trying to work out, how do we capture the great teaching, just like the Mozart and the Bach and the Beethoven, the great teaching in a structured way, so that then others might benefit over time and over space from, you know, not merely just any old lesson plan, but a lesson plan that's particularly effective at helping you to learn about, you know, a particular topic. So that, for me, is at least one thing that remains with me, this sense of an interesting... not tension, but, you know, both of these elements exist in music and I think in education. But I look forward to the day where the great lesson plan is something that we see and aspire to and talk about, and not just about, oh, you know, Mr. Jones, my third grade teacher was amazing because, and what you described was, you know, probably the improvisational elements of that teacher's experience. We don't want to lose any of that. It's very important and often very special. But I'm keen to see, you know, more of the other. I'm conscious we're close to time, and Leanne still has some sort of housekeeping matters for us. So, unless are there any burning last thoughts or comments that people have? I wouldn't want to cut anyone off yet, Yale.
I just want to say that this has been really an amazing opportunity for me. I come from. I haven't been part of this community, but I've been in other communities that have been very much interested in design and in trying to abstract design. And it's very interesting to see the similarities and differences between the groups. And I think that there is so much design knowledge in this group. And it's wonderful that there are all these different efforts of trying to abstract that and trying to clarify what is it about specific designs that make them so successful, and how can you connect between different specifics and show what's a general good design. And I think it's great. Thank you very much. Thanks, Diana, for inviting me.
No, and thank you for joining us. And some of those other communities, the CSCL community and some others, I hope in time we can start to network some of these and see more of that crossover. I think that would be a great thing in the future too. All right, well, my thanks to everyone, for all the presenters and everyone who's done so much to make this a fantastic event today. I'll now pass over to Leanne with the important closing information.
Thank you, James. We are obviously Australian, and to organise this conference from the other side of the world is logistically quite interesting to do. And we've done it a few times now, but it has never been as easy as it was this time. I hope you've appreciated this facility. I've just left a room that filmed every presenter with 8 cameras. Look at this. The staff here is just absolutely amazing. So we will be putting up, for those people who are happy to do that, we will be putting up the presentations on the website. It won't be up this week. but we will get it up there. So the conference website will be a record of this event, and so feel free to go back. I will be emailing your clip if you're a presenter, so you can approve before it does go up. But it will be a really fantastic resource. Now, I would like to thank Gráinne for offering this facility. She was very good about it. She said, yes, yes, we can have it here, and then introduced me to Janet, who organised it. But Gráinne was very good. She pointed us in the right direction all the way, so we really appreciate it. But the person that has been the backbone to this, and there's been a lot of people behind the scenes, of course. I've just been over in the production lab for the filming, and there's all these people over there that you probably didn't see all day, but they were there. But I sent many, many very, very long emails to Janet Dyson, very specific, because we do know what we need now. We're getting quite good at this. And it's lists and lists and lists of things. I need this, I need this, and questions. She's the first person I've ever sent an email like that to answer every single bullet point that I sent. So thank you so much.